sleep under heated blankets, electric coffee maker, really roughing it.
He shifted in his seat.
You asked me for some advice. I'm going to tell you the same thing I told my girls before they married. Marry the man who's going to walk with you through the next 50 or 60 years. Open doors, hold your hand, make your coffee, rub lotion on the cracks of your feet, put you up on a pedestal where you belong. Is he marrying your face and your bottle blonde hair? Or will he love you when you look like whoever you're going to look like in 50 years? I broke the silence. Grover, you missed your calling. He chuckled, checking his instruments. How's that? Dr. Phil's got nothing on you. You should have had your own television show. Just you, a couch, and one audience member at a time. Another laugh. You two walked into my hangar tonight and saw a blue and yellow plane piloted by a crusty old man with age spots on his hands and an angry little dog at his heels. A quick hop to Denver so you can get on with your busy, scheduled, emailed, voicemailed, text-messaged lives. He shook his head. I see an enclosed capsule that lifts you up above the problems of the earth and gives you a perspective you can't get on land, where you can see clearly. He waved his hands across the landscape passing below us in shadows. All of us spend our days looking through lenses that are smudged, fogged up, scratched, and some broken. But this here, he tapped the stick, this pulls you out from behind the lenses, and for a few brief seconds gives you 20/20 vision. Ashley's tone was quiet.
That why you love flying?
He nodded. Sometimes Gail and I will come up here and spend 2 or 3 hours not saying a word, and not feeling like we need to. Not filling the air with a bunch of static. She'll sit back there, put her hand on my shoulder, and we'll skirt the earth. And when we land, all the world seems right. We were quiet several minutes. Then he coughed. Grover grunted something low and guttural. He grabbed his chest, leaned forward, pushed off his headset, and his head slammed against the side of the glass. He arched his back, then grabbed his shirt and pulled, tearing the shirt and popping off the buttons. He lunged forward, hunched over the stick, jerked the stick hard right, and then dipped the wing 90 degrees toward the earth. The mountain rose up to meet us. It felt like we were falling off a tabletop. Just before we hit, he corrected her, pulled back on the stick, and the plane began to stall. Our speed slowed to almost nothing, and I remember hearing treetops brushing the underside of the plane. Then, as if he'd done it 1,000 times, he pancaked the plane against the mountain. The tail touched first, then the left wing, which hit something and snapped off. The weight of the right wing pulled on the plane, tilting us and making an anchor of sorts. Somewhere in there, Grover cut the engine. The last thing I remember was spinning, somersaulting, and the tail breaking off. Then I heard a loud crack. Ashley screamed, the dog barked and floated through the air. Snow peppered my face, followed by the sound of breaking tree limbs, followed by the impact. The last image I remember seeing was the green blob inching across the bluish glow of the dash-mounted GPS. Chapter 4. Having just met Ashley, who reminds me a lot of you, I was thinking about the day we met. After school, I was standing on the track, a good bit warmer then than I am now. We were running quarters when the cross-country team came skimming across the field. Actually, the team was clustered in a group, several hundred meters behind a breakaway single girl. You were floating, barely skimming the surface of the grass, a concert of arms over legs, controlled by some unseen puppeteer above. A sophomore on the cross-country team, I'd seen you before. Word was that distance was your specialty. Your hair was cut short, like Julie Andrews in The Sound of Music. You jumped the trackside bench with little effort, then the high hurdle next to me. Your breathing was deep, rhythmic, purposeful. Somewhere over the hurdle, you shot a glance at me. The whites of your eyes rolled right and revealed the jade-green emeralds in the center. Your whipping arms and fingers slung sweat across my legs and stomach. I heard myself say, "Wow." Then I tripped over a hurdle, causing a loud crash. In that single second, you broke your concentration, or allowed it to be broken. The corner of your lip turned up, your eyes lit. Then your feet touched down. The emeralds disappeared. Whites returned, and you were gone. I watched you running away, over obstacles, seldom around. The ground rose and fell beneath you, having little impact on your up-and-down movement. Laser beam focus, and yet your face seemed disconnected from the turret, able to operate on its own. I think I must have said wow a second time, because my teammate Scott smacked me in the back of the head. "Don't even think about it." "What?" "Rachel Hunt. She's taken, and you don't stand a chance."
"Why not?"
"Two words." He held up two fingers like a peace sign. "Nate Kelsey." I had yet to take my eyes off you. The picture of Nate entered my mind. He played middle linebacker, had no neck, and set the state bench press record the last 3 years. You crossed the infield and the adjoining practice field and then ran out of view near the girls' lockers.
"I can take him."
Scott smacked me in the back of the head again. "Boy, you need a keeper." But that was all it took. Coach's wife worked in the dean's office. She was always trying to set me up. When I asked her for your class schedule, she gladly typed and printed it. Soon after, I discovered I had an insatiable desire to make a change in my third period elective. My advisor was not persuaded.
"You want to take what?"
"Latin."
"Why?"
"'Cause I think it's cool when people speak it." "People haven't spoken Latin since Rome fell."
"Rome fell?"
He was not impressed.
"Ben?"
"Well, they should. It's time for the Latin Renaissance." He shook his head.
"What's her name?"
"Rachel Hunt." He signed my change form and smiled.
"Why didn't you just say that?"
"Next time I will."
"Good luck. You'll need it."
"Thanks." He leaned around his desk.
"You got health insurance?"
"Yeah. Why?"
"You seen her boyfriend?"
I got to class early and watched you walk in. If I hadn't been seated, my knees would have buckled. You looked at me, smiled, and walked straight toward me. Set your books on the table to my left. Then you spun, tilted your head, smiled, and stuck out your hand. "I'm Rachel."
"Hi."
"Okay, okay. Maybe I stammered a bit." I remember looking at your eyes and thinking, I'd never seen green like that. Big, round. They reminded me of that snake in the Jungle Book that was always trying to hypnotize people. You said, "You're Ben Payne." My jaw fell open, and I nodded. In the hallway, one of my teammates was slapping a knee, laughing at me.
"You know me?"
"Everybody knows you."
"They do?"
"Fast as you run, who doesn't?" Maybe my dad wasn't such a bad guy after all. You smiled, looked like you wanted to say something else, but shook your head, turned away. Maybe I was a tad self-conscious.
"What?"
You turned your head sideways, half smiling. "Anyone ever told you you have a nice voice?" My finger touched my voice box. My voice rose about 8 octaves.
"No."
I cleared my throat. "I mean..."
"Lower this time."
"No."
You opened a notebook, started flipping through it. You crossed one leg over the other.
"Well, you do. It's warm."
"Oh." We spent the rest of the year as friends, because I didn't have the you-know-whats to ask you out. Not to mention the fact that Mr. No-Neck could break me in half, if he could catch me. Junior year, I had just arrived at school, had about 30 minutes before the first bell rang, and we bumped into each other as you were walking out of the girls' locker room. Your hair was wet from the shower. Your eyes had narrowed, and a deep wrinkle had creased the area between them. You okay? You turned, eyes wet, and began walking toward the track and bleachers, away from school. Your fists were clenched.
No!
I took your pack, and together we walked out onto the track, circling the obvious. What's wrong? You were exasperated.
I'm not getting any faster, that's what.
You want help with that? Your nose wrinkled.
You can help me?
Well, yeah, at least I think so. I pointed at the cross-country coach's office. I'm pretty sure he can't help you. If he could, he would have told you by now. You weren't convinced.
Oh, and you can see something he can't?
I nodded. You stopped and threw up your arms.
What, then?
Your arms. Too much lateral movement, not forward, and... I waved my hand over your hip flexor.
You're too tight in here. Your stride's too short. Your feet are fast, but you need to cover more ground with each stride. Maybe 2 inches would help.
Your lips turned down. Like I just said, you looked fat in that outfit.
Oh, really?
Another nod. I was starting to look over my shoulder for your boyfriend. To my recollection, this was the longest period of time we'd ever spent talking alone and in public. You put your hands on your hips.
And you can fix this?
Well, I can't really fix it. You do that. But I can run alongside you and help you see it differently. Maybe help you find a rhythm that will cause you to lengthen it. Like running down a sidewalk, you naturally either start trying to land on the crack or miss it. Run with someone who has a longer stride, and then let your brain kick in. Either way, your stride adjusts without your thinking about it.
And you do that?
Well, of course. Who wouldn't? You crossed your arms.
Until now, you. You're the only one who won't give me the time of day.
I was still looking over my shoulder. I could almost hear him breathing down my back. What about number 54, the guy with no neck?
In case you haven't heard, Einstein, we stopped dating. Last year.
Oh. I scratched my head. You did? You shook your head. You may be fast out here, you waved your hand across the track, then tapped me in the chest. But when it comes to this thing, I can run circles around you.
You still do.
Chapter 5. It was dark and the pain had worsened. I pressed the light button on my watch, 4:47 a.m. Maybe 6 hours had elapsed since the crash, another 2 to daylight. This high, maybe earlier. But in this cold, I wasn't sure I'd last another 15 minutes. I was shivering so hard my teeth were clattering. Grover was covered in 4 inches of snow. I was still buckled into my harness, and my seat had broken at the hinge. Ashley lay on my left. I touched her neck and carotid artery. Her pulse was strong and elevated, but she was quiet. I couldn't see her in the dark. I felt around me. Snow and broken glass covered us. To my right, I found the compression sack strapped to the underside of Grover's seat. I pulled, and the sleeping bag came out slowly. I unzipped the side and spread it over us as much as I could. I could only move a little at a time because the pain in my rib cage left me breathless. I tucked the bag around her, slipping her feet into the end. The unnatural cant of her leg told me she was in a bad way. The dog tucked himself in with me. I pressed the light button again. 5:59 a.m. The light was a fuzzy green. The numbers a fuzzy black. Several feet in front of me, I saw the propeller protruding into the air, caked in snow. Part of the blade was missing. Daylight broke, and I woke to the dog standing on my chest, licking my nose. The sky was gray and still dumping snow. Grover, a few feet away, had mostly disappeared beneath what looked like a foot of it. Somewhere, an evergreen tree grew out of the earth, and one of its limbs extended into view. I tucked my hands under my armpits. The down sleeping bag was both good and bad. It was warming me up, which was good, increasing blood flow. Now maybe the cold wouldn't kill me, but with blood flow came more pain in my ribs. Ashley still lay next to me, silent and unmoving. I touched her neck again. Her pulse was still strong and not as elevated, meaning her body had burned through the adrenaline that flooded her system when we crashed. I sat up and tried to examine her. Her face was swollen and caked with blood due to the cuts above her eyes and on her scalp. I ran my hand along her shoulder. It looked like someone had stuffed a sock inside her down jacket. Her shoulder was dislocated, hanging low from the socket. I slid my arm up her sleeve, pulled down, and let the tendons pull the bone back and snap it into the socket. Once in place, I manipulated the joint. It was loose and had a good bit of side-to-side movement, which told me she'd done that before, but it was back where it belonged. Shoulders were pretty good about going back into place if you start them in the right direction. Without undressing her and talking to her, I couldn't get a handle on whether she had any internal injuries. I ran my hands along her hips, fit, lean, muscular. Then her legs. Her right was fine, her left was not. The femur had broken when the plane smashed into a rock upon impact. Probably the source of the scream. Her thigh was grossly swollen, maybe twice its normal size, and her pant leg was taut. Fortunately, the bone had not broken the skin. I knew I had to set it before she woke up, but before I could do that, I needed space to work. Currently, I felt like I was in an MRI machine with all the sides too close to my face. I sat up and found that we were encased in a snow and plain fuselage cave, which, from a certain perspective, was good. The impact, along with the storm, had buried us in a snowbank, then mostly covered us up. That formed a snow cocoon, and while that sounds bad, and it was, it also meant that we were more or less maintaining 32 degrees, which was better than whatever the outside temperature was, not to mention that it kept the wind chill from cutting through us. The majority of the light was coming in through the plexiglass atop the plane, filtering through the snow and letting me see to work. While I worked to dig away the snow to make room to get at her leg, the dog whined and spun in circles. Then he climbed up on Grover's lap and started licking the snow away from his face. He wanted to know when this plane was taking off. I pulled at the snow with my fingers, but that only lasted a minute before my hands got too cold. I realized that if I kept it up, my hands would be useless. I dug around in front of Grover and found a plastic clipboard wedged into the pocket of the door. I pulled off the papers and used the clipboard like a shovel. It was slow work, but I dug a cavity or shelf in the snow that was long enough for Ashley to lie in. It also meant that once I got her in there, I could get at her left leg. I pulled the bag off of her, laid it flat inside the shelf, and then slowly slid and lifted her body across the seat and onto the shelf. The effort exhausted me, so I fell back against Grover's seat and sat there breathing, still short and shallow, trying to lessen the pain in my chest. The dog walked around me and hopped up on my lap, licking my face. "Hey, boy," I whispered. I couldn't remember his name. 30 minutes passed before I had enough energy to return to her leg. I sat up and spoke to her, but she didn't respond, which was good, because what I was about to do was going to hurt her more than the initial break. I took off my belt, wrapped it around her ankle, and then my wrist, giving me an anchor to pull on. Then I took off my left hiking boot and slowly placed my left foot between her legs. I straightened my leg, pressing it against her, then tightened the belt and grabbed her foot with both hands. I took 4 or 5 deep breaths and felt her hand slide onto my foot. I looked up and saw that one eye was partly open. She patted my foot and mumbled, "Pull. Hard." I pulled, pushed with my leg, and arched my back all at the same time. The pain shot through her, her head rocked back, and she uttered a muffled scream before losing consciousness. The leg popped loose. I turned it, let it straighten itself naturally, and then let go. When I let go, the left leg hung to the side in a mostly natural position that mirrored the right. There are two keys to the healing of a broken leg, setting it correctly and then holding it in place while the bones fuse. Neither is easy. With the leg set, I began looking for a brace. Above my head hung two mangled wing supports, more than 3 feet long and about as big around as my index finger, that had ripped in two when the left wing became disconnected from the plane. I began working them both back and forth, weakening the metal, and they eventually snapped off. When hiking, I carried two pocket knives, a Swiss Army knife and a folding single-bladed knife with a lock. Given that I had passed through security in the airport, both had been packed into my backpack to be carried in the belly of the plane. The pack lay behind us, mostly submerged into the snowbank. Only a corner was visible. I pulled away some snow, found the zipper, and slid my hand around inside until I found the knives. My Swiss Army knife has two blades. Using the smaller, I slit Ashley's pant leg up her thigh to her hip. The leg was swollen, and much of the thigh was black and blue. A deep purple, even. The belt restraints on both seats were comprised of an over-the-shoulder harness system with a typical quick-release buckle. I loosened ours from our seat and used both pieces of one harness to secure the poles I'd just removed from the wings. The buckles, while bulky, gave me the opportunity to tighten and loosen the brace. I secured the brace around her leg, tightened the straps so they were snug, and placed the buckle directly above her femoral artery. Then I took a T-shirt from my suitcase, cut it in two, and wound each piece into a straight, taut, tube-like piece which I placed beneath either side of the buckle. This allowed me to snug the buckles further, tightening the brace, while taking the pressure off the artery and giving her leg ample blood flow, which it was going to need. Lastly, and while she may not have liked any of my former actions, she certainly was not going to like this. I packed the area around the break in snow. I had to be careful to bring down the swelling while not dropping her core temperature. I reached further into my backpack and pulled out a pair of Polypro long underwear and a wool sweater I wear when I'm on mountains. It's a little tattered, but it's lined with a windstopper fabric, and it keeps me warm even when it's wet. I pulled off her down jacket, her suit coat, her blouse, her bra, and checked her chest and ribs for any evidence of internal injuries. No bruises had surfaced. I slid her into my long underwear and sweater, which was too big but dry and warm. Then I slid her back into her down jacket, but didn't pull her hands through the sleeves. I pulled a sleeping bag beneath her, wrapped her up like a mummy with only her left leg hanging out, then elevated and covered her left foot. We lose half our body heat from our head, so I pulled a wool beanie from my pack and slid her head into it, pulling it down over her ears and forehead, but not covering up her eyes. I didn't want her to wake up and think she'd either died or was blind. Once she was dry and warm, I realized how shallow my breathing and elevated my pulse had become. The pain in my ribs had intensified. I pushed my arms into my jacket, then lay down next to her to get warm. When I did, the dog walked across my legs, walked in two circles while his nose stretched to find his tail, and burrowed between us. He looked like he'd done that before. I stared across at Grover's snow-covered body. I closed my eyes, and as I did, the fingers on Ashley's left hand extended through her jacket and touched my arm. I sat up in time to see her lips move, but I couldn't understand. I leaned closer. Her fingers squeezed around my palm and her lips moved again. Thank you. Chapter 6. It's daylight. The snow is still falling heavy and I can see my breath, blowing smoke. It's also really quiet, like somebody hit the mute button on the world. Ashley is not doing too well. She may have some internal injuries. I set her leg and her shoulder, but she'll need an X-ray on both and surgery on her leg when we get out of here. She passed out when I set her leg. She's been asleep since, talking some in her sleep. She's got several lacerations on her arms, face, and head, but I didn't want to move her any more than I had to. I need her to wake up and talk to me before I start sewing. I found a fly fishing vest behind my seat filled with some monofilament that I can use for stitching. Grover, the pilot, he didn't make it. Did I already tell you that? I can't remember. He landed the plane after his heart had stopped. I don't know how putting that plane down without killing all of us was nothing short of heroic. Me? I broke a few ribs, maybe three. The pain on inhaling is sharp, piercing, and I may have a collapsed lung. Of course, the elevation here is above 11,000 feet, so breathing isn't all that easy anyway. I've been thinking about the possibility of a rescue, but I can't think of any reason we should expect one. We didn't tell anyone we were getting on the plane. Grover wasn't required to file a flight plan. He never told anyone he had passengers, so the tower had no idea we were on the plane. From the side, Grover sort of looked like Dad, or like the better parts of him, although Grover struck me as a bit kinder. Some people said Dad was a jerk, domineering. Others said I was lucky to have such a committed father. Of course, those folks wouldn't have lasted a day in my house. Mom didn't. He abused her. She crawled inside a bottle, and he made sure he had enough evidence to keep her hopping from one rehab center to the next, which allowed him to strip her of parental rights for good. He seldom lost. I don't know the whole story. He let me talk to her by phone. Fleetwood Mac talks about leather and lace. My dad was handy with the leather. Our home had no lace, at least until you crept through the window. From the moment he clicked on the light at 4:55 a.m., I had 5 minutes to be standing at the back door, dressed, two pair of sweats, running shorts, and shoes.
Miles don't run themselves. Get your butt out of bed.
Yes, sir. Most nights I slept dressed. I remember the first time you snuck in and tugged me on the shoulder. You looked surprised. Why are you wearing all these clothes? I looked at the clock and then at the door. You stay here about 4 hours and you'll find out. You shook your head. No, thanks. When you figured out I was wearing two pair, you asked, aren't you hot? You get used to it. You tugged on me. Come on, let's get out of here. To the lifeguard station and back, 6 miles. I don't know why he chose six, but that was the number. He called it my warm-up. I think it had more to do with the donut shop than anything else. Cheating was impossible because he'd drive to the shop, sit next to the glass, stare out over the ocean, coffee in one hand, donut in the other, paper flat on the table, checking my time as I trudged up the beach and slapped the red lifeguard's chair. If I was up a few seconds, or fast, he'd finish his donut, beat me home, and say nothing. But if I was slow, he'd run out of the shop and shout across the sand, "Down 7! Or down 20! I learned how to run within myself, monitoring and gauging output and speed. Fear does that. When I got home, he met me on the beach, where I was allowed to pull off both pair of sweats before I started my speed work. Mondays, we ran 12 660s, as in 660 meters. Tuesdays were 550s, Wednesdays 330s, and so on. Sunday was my only free day. But it was a mixed pleasure, because Monday was just around the corner. We always finished with a speed rope, sit-ups, crunches, push-ups, a medicine ball, and whatever other pain-inducing thing he could dream up. He had this piece of bamboo he'd hold out above my knees.
Higher!
I'd lift them, but they were never high enough. He'd shake his head and speak softly. Pain is weakness leaving your body. I'd stand there, lifting my knees, staring down the beach and thinking to myself, good. Why don't we let some out of your body? I'm about out. I lost a lot of pain in his house. By 7 a.m., I'd have run 7 to 10 miles, depending on what day of the week it was. Then I'd go to school, try not to fall asleep in class, and then go back to track practice or run with the cross-country team, both of which seemed mundane in comparison. Dad was managing his firm, 50 traders, all reporting to him, and if they didn't pull their weight, he sent them packing. No mercy. Because the stock market closed at 4, he would appear about 4:15, loose and tie, stopwatch in hand, sunglasses, wrinkled forehead, staring at me over the fence.
Yeah, he was committed, all right.
My freshman year, I won the 400-meter dash in 50.9 seconds, anchored the 4x400-meter relay, and won the mile in 4 minutes and 28 seconds. That made me state champion in 3 events. Dad drove me home in silence. No celebration dinner, no day off, no moment. He parked the car.
5 o'clock will come early. If you're going to break 4 minutes by your senior year, you've got some work to do.
Somewhere in there, it occurred to me that, to my dad, I was only as good as my last time. And in truth, no time was ever good enough. When it came to school, B's were not accepted, and an A-minus might as well be a B-plus, so you better pull it up. I had few friends, and if I wasn't in school, I was either running or sleeping. Then came my sophomore year. I'd broken several state and national records. That didn't necessarily make me the big man on campus. Football players had all that wrapped up. But it did give me a reputation with folks who'd follow that stuff, like cross-country runners.
Like you. You entered the picture and lit my world with laughter and light and wonder.
Welcome and warm. You ran by me, a dart of the eyes, a quick glance, flicking sweat off your fingertips, and I wanted to take a shower, wash off Dad and bathe in you. So much of what I am, he made, forged it in me. I know that. But Dad used pain to rid me of pain, leaving me empty and hurting. You poured in you and filled me up. For the first time, I felt no pain. You gave me the one thing he never did. Love, absent a stopwatch.
Chapter 7.
It was dark when I woke. I pressed the light button on my watch. 12:01 a.m., an entire day had passed. Then I checked the date. It took a second to register. Make that 2 days. We'd slept 36 hours straight. A billion stars stared down on me, close enough to touch. The big green blob had come and gone, having spread a thick white blanket in its wake. The moon had appeared over my left shoulder, big as Christmas. I squinted my eyes. If I could climb the mountain to my left, I could step right onto the moon and keep walking. As sleep pressed in, I made a mental list, which included 2 things, food and water, and we needed both soon, with emphasis on water. If Ashley was fighting infection, I needed to get her kidneys working, and I needed to get her hydrated. Shock has a way of burning up your fluids, and while I may not have been conscious of it, I had been in shock and running on adrenaline since the crash. Tomorrow would be difficult, especially at this elevation. If I could get the GPS working, I'd try to figure out where we were, because I knew better than to expect a rescue. I considered the facts. We'd notified no one, and even if someone had known we'd gotten on the plane, we were, by Grover's own calculation, more than 150 miles off course, thanks to the storm winds. It'd be weeks before a search grid brought anyone this far out, if at all. If an air rescue were coming, and they knew exactly where to look and what to look for, we'd have seen or heard something. We had not. Or worse, we'd slept through it. Our only hope was the ELT. Daylight lit a blue sky. I tried to move, but I was so stiff it hurt to pick up my head. If you've ever been in a car wreck, you know what I mean. The wreck hurts, but 2 or 3 days later, the hurt really sets in. I sat up and leaned against a large boulder protruding from the snowbank. Given its location, I thought it might have been the rock that broke Ashley's leg. Daylight and some clarity allowed me to see what had happened to the plane and us. When the plane touched down, we hit what looked like about 8 feet of snow along with trees and the side of a huge rock. As we neared ground, a tree or rock outcropping ripped off the left wing. That left the plane heavier on the right, so with the right wing pointed toward the ground, we hit a second time, flipping us. Somewhere in the third or fourth flip, the right wing caught again and dug what remained of the nose into the snow, sort of corkscrewing us. That swept us into another rock outcropping. Probably the one next to my head would smash the side of the plane and Ashley's leg. The result left a relatively intact fuselage buried into a 10-foot snowdrift, packed up against a rock ledge, and what looked like trees growing out of the rocks. Bad news first. While Grover's plane was bright blue and yellow, all but the left wing was buried several feet down. Needle in a haystack came to mind. Not to mention that the tail disintegrated when it hit the boulder. I'd found bright orange pieces of plastic, but no ELT. Hence, no signal on 122.5. No triangulation. No cavalry. The truth was hard to swallow. I didn't know how I'd break it to Ashley. The only good news, if you could call it that, was that this burial gave us a measure of protection from the elements. Otherwise, we'd be already dead from exposure. 32 degrees above zero is better than 32 below. Ashley lay sleeping, and her face was flushed, which probably meant fever, which probably meant infection. Neither of which were good, but both of which I expected. I had to get some fluids into her. The best I could do was crawl, so I rolled in my backpack, dug out my jet boil, and filled the canister with fresh powder from just outside the cave. I clicked it on. The blue flame erupted, melted the snow. As it melted, I added more. Either the noise of the burner or my movement woke her. Her face was puffy, swollen, and her eyes were slits. Her bottom lip was fat, and now that it was daylight, I needed to clean her cuts and start sewing the ones that needed stitches. I held a cup of warm water to her lips. "Drink this." She sipped. I had a bottle of Advil somewhere in my pack. I desperately wanted to down about four, but I knew she was in more pain and would need them more than I in the days to come. I found them in a side pocket, dumped four into my hand, and held one to her lips. "Can you swallow this?" She nodded. I placed it on her tongue, and she swallowed. We repeated this three more times. Slowly. The snow around her leg had long since melted, so the swelling, while it might have gone down at one time, was back. And swelling brought pain. If I could reduce the size of her leg, I could also reduce the pain. The Advil worked from the inside. Snow would work on the outside. I repacked her leg, gently, with snow, and felt for the pulse around her ankle to make sure she was getting good circulation. I kept holding the cup to her lips until she finished the whole thing. That meant 8 ounces. My goal for the day would be 5 more of those. 48 ounces of fluid would remind her kidneys to get to work. I refilled a cup in the jet boil, taking some fluid myself. Ashley forced her eyes open as much as the swelling would allow. She scanned the cave, what was left of the plane, the dog, her torn clothing, the brace on her leg, and then her eyes settled on Grover's body. She stayed there a minute, then looked at me. "Is he?" He was gone before the plane touched down. "Heart, I guess. I don't know how he landed it." She reached up, walking her fingertips across her face and head. Her expression changed. Slowly, I pulled her hand down. "I need to stitch you up." Her voice was hoarse. "What day is it?" I gave her the short version. When I finished, she didn't say anything. I dug through Grover's fly fishing vest and found some fine monofilament. I stripped one of the flies off the vest and removed all the stuff that made it look like a fly, exposing a single barbless hook. I needed to straighten the hook to more of a 90-degree angle, but I needed a tool, something to help me straighten the hook. Grover's belt. I dug through the snow around his waist and found the Leatherman. When I popped open the snap on the holster, his stiff body didn't move. I needed to bury him, but I also needed to get Ashley stitched up, and I needed to find some food. He'd have to wait. I straightened the hook, threaded the monofilament through the eye, and tried to flatten the eye with the pliers. When I looked back at Ashley, tears were rolling down her face. She said, "I'm sure his wife is worried about him." We hadn't talked yet about our predicament. the being stuck part. One of the things I've learned both in medicine and climbing mountains is that you attack one crisis at a time. The next was her face and head. I used the Leatherman and dug out a second shelf in the snow lower than the makeshift shelf on which Ashley now lay. In my practice, following surgery, I have a habit of going to my patients' rooms and checking on them. Oftentimes, I'll roll a stainless steel stool on wheels up to the side of the bed, the level of which actually puts me lower than most of them, allowing them to look down or at least straight at me. Ever noticed how it's hard to look up when you come out of surgery? Me too. This shelf next to Ashley accomplished the same sort of thing. Maybe it has something to do with bedside manner. The wind gusted, scraping the branch across the plexiglass. I was finally able to dig my sleeping bag out of my pack and spread it on the shelf next to her. Until now, we'd been sharing. Now, we each had our own. I held a cup to her lips, and she sipped. I wiped the tear from her face. "What hurts?" She glanced at Grover's body.
"Him."
"What else?"
"My heart."
"Physically or emotionally?" She laid her head back.
"Do you know how long I've wanted to get married? Look forward to, even planned my wedding? Like, all my life?"
"How about on your body?"
"Everything."
"I'm not finished hurting you. I need to sew a few stitches." She nodded. Three places. The first required two stitches in her scalp, which were relatively painless. The second was along the top of her right eye, running through the middle of her eyebrow. An older scar had split upon impact. I pierced the skin with a hook and said, "There's an older scar here."
"Nationals. I was 18. Other kid caught me with a roundhouse, never saw it."
I tied the first stitch and started on the second.
"Knock you out?"
"No. Maybe mad."
"Why?"
"'Cause I knew it was gonna mess up my prom pictures."
"What did you do?"
"Caught him with a spinning back kick followed by a double round and finally an axe kick, which cockroached him."
"Cockroached?"
"We had names for the positions that people fell in when we knocked him out."
I distracted her.
"Such as the porpoise, the white man's dance, the cockroach, a few others." I tied the third knot and cut the line. I nodded at her eyebrow.
"What I've done is good enough to hold you until we can get you to a hospital and let a good plastic surgeon fix my band-aid."
"What about my pretty two-poled brace? My leg is killing me."
"It's the best I can do."
I said it, but without an x-ray, it's hard to tell. "Again, when we get to a hospital, they can take some pictures and check it. If it's not aligned, I'll recommend, and I'm sure they'll agree, that they'll re-break it and give you a few presents that will set off the metal detector when you pass through security. Either way, you'll be good as new."
"You've just said get to a hospital twice, but do you really think anybody's coming?"
As we looked up at the blue sky through the hole created between the leaning wing and the 8-foot snow wall, we saw a commercial airliner cruising at what looked like 30,000 feet. It had been nearly 60 hours since our crash, and we hadn't heard a sound other than our own voices or the wind or a scratching limb. And that plane was so high, we couldn't hear it either. I shook my head. "We can see them just fine, but I'm pretty certain they can't see us. Any evidence of our disappearance lies under 3 feet of snow. Won't be seen until July when it melts."
"Don't crash planes send out some sort of SOS signal or something?"
"Yes, but the thing that sends it is lying all around us in about 1,000 little pieces."
"Maybe you should crawl out there and wave your shirt or something."
I chuckled, which hurt. I clutched my side. Her eyes narrowed.
"What's up?"
"A couple of broken ribs."
"Let me see."
I pulled up my shirt. I hadn't seen it in the daylight and figured that the bruise would have set in by now. The whole left side of my ribcage was a deep purple. "Only hurts when I breathe." We laughed. She looked up at me, her head not moving,
as I tied the sixth knot in her arm. She looked more worried.
I can't believe I'm lying here like this with you sewing on me, in the middle of God only knows where, and we're laughing.
You think there's something wrong with us? Chances are good.
I turned my attention to the side of her arm. Either the rock or a branch had cut the skin on her non-dislocated shoulder, about 4 inches in length. Fortunately for her, when the plane came to a stop with her unconscious in it, she was pressed up against the snow on that shoulder. Pressure, mixed with snow, stopped the bleeding. It would need 12 or more stitches.
Give me your hand, she did. I need you to slip your arm out of your sleeve.
She pulled slowly, wincing. By the way, where'd I get this handsome shirt?
I changed you sometime yesterday. You were wet.
That was my favorite bra.
I pointed over my left shoulder. You can have it back once it dries out.
The cut on her arm was news to her. She looked down at it. I didn't even know I had that one.
I explained about the snow and pressure and tied off another stitch. She watched me work and spoke without looking at me.
What do you think our chances are?
You don't beat around the bush, do you?
What's the use? Sugarcoating it won't get us out of here any faster.
Good point, I shrugged. Let me ask you a few questions. Did you tell anyone you were getting on this plane?
She shook her head.
No email, phone call, no nothing?
Another slow shake.
So nobody on planet Earth knows you stepped into a charter plane and attempted to fly to Denver?
A final shake.
Me either.
She whispered. I imagine everyone thinks or thought until yesterday that I was still in Salt Lake. By this point, they'd be looking for me.
But where would they look?
For all they know, I took a voucher and started toward the hotel.
I nodded. Based on the way Grover was talking, I can't for the life of me think of any reason why anyone would come looking for us. There's no official record that we flew, because he filed no flight plan. And according to him and something about VFR, he didn't need to. And here's the best one. My favorite, actually. We, two professionals with probably 20 years of combined college and graduate schooling between us, never told a single living soul we were going. I paused. It's as if this flight never existed.
She stared at Grover. It existed, all right. She paused, her eyes lifting upward. I just thought it'd be a quick hop to Denver, outrun the storm, make 2 new friends in the process, and life would continue.
I cut the line. Ashley, I'm really sorry. I shook my head. You should be somewhere getting a manicure or a pedicure or something, getting ready for a rehearsal dinner.
Don't, she shook her head. Don't beat yourself up over good intentions. I was glad you offered.
She stared around her. Not so much now, but was then. She laid her head back. I was scheduled to go with my girlfriends to the spa and get a massage. You know, one of those hot rocks deals? Instead, I'm lying on ice with only one rock.
She nodded at her friend behind me. And no heat. Somewhere out there is a dress with no girl and a groom with no bride.
She shook her head.
Do you have any idea how much I paid for that dress?
It'll be waiting on you when you get there. Him too. I held the cup to her lips and she sipped a final time, finishing off 24 ounces. Your sense of humor is a gift.
Well, would you think it funny if I told you I had to pee?
From a certain point of view, that's good. I looked at the bag and her immobility. From another, it's not.
Which way are we looking at it?
We're looking at it from whatever way lets you go without putting pressure on that leg. I looked around. What I wouldn't give for a catheter.
Oh, no, let's don't. Those things give me the creeps. That part of me is not an innie. It's an out-only sort of thing.
I grabbed a Nalgene bottle out of my pack and laid it next to her. All right, here's the deal.
I'm not going to like this, am I? It's better than the alternative, and you get to stay right there. But I've got to help. I pulled out my Swiss Army knife and opened the blade. I'm going to finish slitting your pantsuit on up to the side of your hip. That way, while you're lying there, you can lay it over you. Then, since there's about 12 feet of snow below you, I'm going to dig a hole beneath your butt big enough for my hand in this bottle. Then we're going to ease your underwear out of the way, and you're going to go in this bottle. You're right. I don't like this. We need to measure your urine output, and I need to see if there's any blood in it.
Blood?
Internal injuries. Don't you think I've had enough of those?
What, injuries?
She nodded. Yes, but we need to make sure. I slid her pants, pulled them aside, dug out the snow beneath her, held the bottle in place, and she used her one healthy arm to lift herself slightly, without changing the position of her leg. She looked at me. Can I go? I nodded. She went. She shook her head. This has got to be one of the more embarrassing moments I've ever shared with another human being. Given that I blend orthopedics and emergency medicine, there are a few days that go by that I don't study several people's urine, even inserting the catheter. She winced, stopping the flow. You okay? She nodded.
Just my leg.
She relaxed and started again. The sound of a rush of liquid filling the empty bottle rose from beneath her. After a second, she said,
Your fingers are cold.
If it makes you feel any better, my fingers are too cold to feel anything.
Gee, that's a relief.
I tried to deflect her discomfort. Most of the folks I see in the ER have suffered some trauma, meaning an accident, which usually means a substantial impact, which means internal injuries, which can mean blood in their urine. She looked at me.
Are you trying to make me feel better?
I pulled up the bottle and studied the color.
Yep.
She looked at me and then at the bottle.
That's a lot of pee.
Yeah, and the color's good, too.
I don't know if I've ever had someone comment on the color of my pee before. I'm not quite sure how to take it.
I helped her dress, slid the sleeping bag back underneath her, and then covered her up. The process of doing so brought her skin into contact with mine, and while I was acting as her doctor, her nakedness, her total vulnerability, was not lost on me. I thought of Rachel. By the time we got it all finished, she was shivering, and I felt like someone had stabbed me with a stiletto in the ribs. I lay down, breathing heavily. She spoke down at me.
You taken anything for the pain?
I shook my head. No.
Why not?
To be honest, if you think you're hurting now, just give it 3 or 4 days. I've only got enough Advil to get you through a week. After that, you're on your own.
She nodded.
I like the way you're thinking, Doc. I've got a few prescription-strength narcotics somewhere in that pack, but I thought I'd save them for tonight when you can't sleep.
You sound almost as if you've done this type of thing before.
Rachel and I love to hike. One of the things we've learned is that while you may have a plan and a hope for what you'll do or how far you might go in any given day, conditions will determine what you do and how far you actually go. Hence, it pays to be prepared, while not carrying so much weight you can't move. She eyed the hole in the snow where my pack was buried.
Got any red wine in there?
Nope. But I can make a gin and tonic if you'd like.
That'd be great.
She eyed her leg. Tell me about this contraption on my leg. Amongst doctors, orthopedists are known as the carpenters. Afraid that's true of me. Good news is this brace is rather effective. Or at least will be for the short term. You can't move around. You're stuck right here or wherever I move you to. But it will keep you from moving it some way you shouldn't and will help protect it. If the pressure gets too tight around your thigh or calf, let me know, and I'll loosen it.
She nodded.
Right now, it's throbbing like somebody hit it with a hammer. I lifted the top of the sleeping bag off her leg and repacked the snow beneath the brake and around the side. I'm going to keep doing this for several days. It'll speed recovery and help anesthetize the pain. Only problem is you're going to be cold.
Going to be?
I screwed the cap on the Nalgene bottle and started crawling toward daylight. I'm going to take a look around and empty this bottle. Good. I'm going to clean up a bit around here. Maybe order a pizza or something. I like pepperoni. Anchovies?
Never touch them.
Got it. I crawled out of the fuselage, or what was left of it, under the wing, around a tree, and into the sunlight. The temperature was probably in the single digits, but I had been expecting worse. I've had people tell me that a dry cold spell isn't quite as bad as a humid cold. But in my book, cold is cold, and 9 degrees is 9 degrees, or whatever it was. I took one step off the packed snow where the plane had landed, and my foot submerged all the way to my groin. The impact shook my chest and started me coughing. I tried not to scream in pain, but I'm afraid I wasn't very successful. Ashley's voice rose up out of the plane. You okay? Yeah, just wishing I had some snowshoes. I dumped the bottle and looked around as best I could. Nothing but snow and mountains. We seemed to be on some sort of plateau with a few higher peaks to my left. But most everything else spread out below and before us. That meant we were higher than I thought. Maybe 11,500. No wonder it was tough to breathe. I'd seen enough. I crawled back in and collapsed on the shelf next to her. Well? She asked. Nothing. Really, you can tell me the truth. I can handle it. Just give it to me straight. Grover was right. More Mars than Earth. No, seriously, don't sugarcoat it. I'm used to people shooting straight with me. I stared up at her where she sat, eyes closed, waiting. It's beautiful. Can't wait for you to see it. The view is panoramic, unlike anything you've ever seen. One in a million. I've got two lawn chairs set up and a little guy with umbrella drinks who will be around in a few minutes. I had to go back and get some ice. She relaxed and laid her head back. The first ear-to-ear grin I'd seen since we'd been in the snow. For a minute there, I was worried. Glad to hear it's not as bad as I thought. Somewhere in there, it struck me that Ashley Knox was one of the stronger human beings I'd ever met. Here she lay, half dead, probably in more pain than most people have felt in their entire lives, in the process of missing her own wedding, not to mention the fact that we had no probable chance of rescue. If we got out of here, it'd be up to us.
Most people would be panicked,
despondent, illogical at this point. But somehow she could laugh. What's more, she made me laugh. And that's something I actually hadn't done in a long while. I was spent. I needed food and I needed rest. But I couldn't get food without rest. I put together a plan. We need food. But I'm in no shape to go find it. I'll go tomorrow. Right now, I'm going to try and build us a fire without melting the cave around us. Keep feeding us both warm water and try and conserve my energy. I like the fire idea. Rescue people will tell you never to leave the site of a crash, and that's true. But we're high, real high, breathing less than half the oxygen we're used to, and we both need it to heal, especially you. Tomorrow, or the next day, I'm going to start thinking about getting to a lower elevation, maybe try and do some scouting. Right now, I turned the mounting screws for the GPS and unplugged it from the dash. I'm going to try and get a fix on where we are while this thing still has life in it. She stared at me. How do you know to do all this? I mean, what if you didn't? When I was a kid, my dad realized I could run faster than most. He took that ability and turned it into his passion, his raison d'être, he called it. And I grew to hate him for it, because no time was ever fast enough and he was always measuring me with this stick that looked an awful lot like a stopwatch. Once Rachel and I were on our own, we gravitated to the mountains. I have good lungs and pretty good legs. So when we could get away from class or the track, we started buying up gear and spent the weekends in the mountains.